Exploring how we can transform our communities in the 21st century with the support of St Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Welcome. This is the Community Safety Podcast with your host, Jim Nixon.
Today, the Community Safety Podcast asks the question, is the drug policy working within the UK? Does drug enforcement work? My guest spent 14 years as an undercover drugs officer infiltrating some very high-level gangs, and here's some very radical views on how we can transform the drug policy in this country. Please take a listen to a snippet of today's interview.
It was crazy because he opened the door and he says, "Who are you?" And this he said, "You're not a student, are you? I fucking hate students." And I thought, that's my cover story. I said, "Yeah, I'm a student." And this woman behind him said, "Is he bloody stupid or what? You just told him you hate students." And the guy laughed. He says, "Yeah, but what idiot would tell me he was a student after that?" So, you know, the implication is that he trusted me because I was so stupid. But to be honest, it wasn't that difficult. Not really. He was always going to sell to me as someone at his door because that tactic wasn't being used. I wasn't, you know, cops weren't expected. It wasn't that tactic didn't go on in the UK. Obviously, I'm not saying we invented undercover policing. That's been going on for decades. But the low-level stuff started in 1993.
It's now time for the Community Safety Podcast.
Welcome to the Community Safety Podcast. This podcast will explore how we can transform communities in the 21st century. I'm delighted to introduce today's guest as Neil Woods. Neil spent 14 years infiltrating drug gangs as an undercover police officer, befriending and gaining the trust of some of the most violent, unpredictable criminals in Britain. With the insight that came only from having fought on its front lines, Neil came to see the true brutality of the war on drugs, that it demonises those who need help and only empowers the very worst elements in society. Neil is on board of LEAP, which is the Law Enforcement Action Partnership in the US, and is chair of the LEAP in the UK. LEAP is an organisation made up exclusively of law enforcement professionals, past and present, who campaign for drug law reforms. Welcome, Neil. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on to the Community Safety Podcast.
Hi, Jim. Thanks for inviting me.
Oh, it's brilliant to have you on board. I've been trying to get you on for a while and it's just fantastic. And actually, you're going to be our last guest of our first season. So you're going to be our 20th guest. So, you know, a little bit of kudos there for you to leave you right to the end. I thought I'd save the best till last.
Oh, well, it's very kind of you to say.
Well, I always start my interviews very much the same. And it's always great to sort of get a little bit of insight into the young Neil Woods. So give me a little bit of an insight into you growing up.
Oh, well, I grew up in, I suppose you'd consider it a very middle-class town of Buxton in the Peak District. And I didn't realise really as a kid how sheltered I was actually. I mean, we weren't a middle-class family particularly, but it's a very middle-class town. And so, I don't know, I was a bit of a geek at school, really, I suppose, into playing Dungeons and Dragons and listening to music like Rush and Yes and things like that. But then I went to university by mistake, because why I ever thought that I would be interested in business studies, I have got no idea. I just can't put myself in that young me, you know, and work out why I decided to do that. Because in a very short space of time, I dropped out. And like some of my friends had dropped out as well. But they'd gone backpacking around Europe, which sounded very exciting. So I thought, well, I'll do that, you know, go on an adventure. And then I saw an advertisement for the police in the local newspaper, the Buxton Advertiser. And so, in not really being able to make my mind up, I flipped a coin and it came up heads. And that's what set me on the long journey, which has brought me here to speak to you today, I suppose.
So like me then, policing was never something that was kind of a childhood aspiration. It was something that kind of effectively was a bit of a means to an end.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, means to an end because it was a job to do and something I could do. But it was also an adventure, though. And that's what I wanted to do, something that was different every day. you know, and so it was either backpacking around Europe trying to find work, or it was going into the police for quite dramatically different things, but it was the same motivation for me.
Yeah, yeah, I was very similar, actually. You know, I sort of got to a point where I was 26, I didn't really know what to do. I always liked helping people, and like you, just thought, you know what, fancy something different every day. And I think that was the kind of motivation for me too. So I suppose we were, and also I was in a very similar situation to you, really, kind of a little bit wet behind the ears, didn't have a massively difficult upbringing. And when I joined the police, and I'm sure, and we'll come on to this in a minute, but I don't know about you, but I found it a bit of an eye-opener. How did you find it?
Oh, I didn't realise how naive I was at all. It was a complete shock to me. You know, my imagination just did not prepare me at all. I found quite quickly, actually, I wasn't very good at it either. I was too young, because I was a young 19-year-old in many ways, and I just didn't deal with conflict very well because I'd never had any. You know, I couldn't work out why people still wanted to hit me, even though I was trying to talk to them nicely, you know. It was the naivety was incredible. Yeah, it was a shock, big shock.
Yeah, I found it exactly the same. Did you struggle for your probation then?
Oh, I hung on by the skin of my teeth. Almost got kicked out a few times, I think. And in fact, I hated the first 2 years, but I was just stubborn and I thought, well, I'm not going to leave before I've proved to myself I can get through the first 2 years. And that's the way I saw it at the time.
So obviously you got through the first 2 years. What was the kind of the way that the undercover work came about? How did you kind of fit into that sort of that expert role, I suppose, that, you know, very few people tread? How did it come about?
Well, I moved from one end of the county to the other. I moved up to the north, to Glossop. And you know what it's like when you move, because the trouble is in the police is if you struggle, what makes it harder is your reputation. Because all of your colleagues look at you as someone who's useless or you can't be trusted to back them up. So when I moved one station from one opposite side of the county to the other, I had a fresh set of, I could make my own new reputation. And that made it so much easier. I suddenly wasn't crap at the job anymore. You know, I managed all right. So I got listed as one of the few people to get an attachment to the drug squad. And the reason that they were suddenly getting rookies on short month attachments is because, I don't know, were you in 93?
I joined in 95.
So you'll remember that in the early to mid-90s, there was a massive push from the government to get police forces to prioritise drugs above everything else, like above massive. Everything. And there was lots of pressure to prove that they were doing it as well. So that was that time. And basically Derbyshire's idea was that if we can share some of the expertise and inspire these young cops, we'll get more results. So that's why, you know, that's why I was one of the people who got that attachment. And then, of course, one of them looked at me one day and said, "Do you fancy having a go at buying some crack cocaine?" Which is an odd question. It was an odd question. And I said, well, yeah, I'll have a go at anything. And, you know, there was a bit of an ops point set up, gave me 20 quid, told me what door to go and knock on, and that was it. No training, no... Knocked on the door and thought, hang on, what am I saying? What's my cover story? Because no one had told me about that.
I was going to say, how did you find that? You know, obviously you're ill prepared. What was that first experience like?
It was crazy because he opened the door and he says, "Who are you?" And this he said, "You're not a student, are you? I fucking hate students." And I thought, that's my cover story. I said, "Yeah, I'm a student." And this woman behind him said, "Is he bloody stupid or what? You just told him you hate students." And the guy laughed. He says, "Yeah, but what idiot would tell me he was a student after that?" So, you know, the implication is that he trusted me because I was so stupid. But to be honest, it wasn't that difficult. Not really. He was always going to sell to me as someone at his door because that tactic wasn't being used. I wasn't, you know, cops weren't expected. It wasn't that tactic didn't go on in the UK. Obviously, I'm not saying we invented undercover policing. That's been going on for decades. But the low-level stuff started in 1993.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Absolutely right. Yeah, and you know, a lot of the dealers there, they weren't really expecting that kind of sort of tactic at all, were they?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So how did it kind of evolve then? You know, obviously you've done that first deal. Clearly, it went okay. How did it kind of get to becoming, I suppose, more a full-time kind of role within the police for you?
Well, I think it's safe to say that that day defined the next 14 years of my life and beyond, really, because, you know, their eyes lit up. You know, when I came back with my little paper twist of crack saying, yeah, I've done it, their eyes lit up because, you know, the benefits were obvious to them, that they could get loads and loads of arrests. So they wanted more and more operations like that. The bosses saw the results and they wanted more and more. So I did a few days at a time, then a few weeks at a time. And in no time at all, I was doing no less than 6 or 7 months at a time. And then within 4 years, I was training others to help, you know, designing the train for other people to do it. And it just exploded. You know, because the results were massive. You know, they were genuinely.
You know what, back then, Neil, when you started to go into this, and it must have been quite scary but exciting at the same time, I did this work for a while, not undercover, but I was very much involved, and I actually thought that I could make a real difference at that time. Did you feel the same, that, you know what, I'm gonna take the drug markets down by storm?
Do you know what I did? Yeah. I mean, the thing is, you know what it's like. The policing specialism, you know, the drugs investigators, the crime squads, proactive units, drug squads, they tend to be the most hardworking, dedicated cops, don't they? Yeah. And they fire off each other, and it becomes such an intense culture that I was completely seduced by that intense specialism. You know, all these people working so hard and putting all those hours in, and yeah, we thought we could. We could change the world, really. And I thought, well, you know, this is the work I want to do. I might have flipped a coin to get into this job, but now I'm fighting the good fight. Now I'm bringing down the characters in these communities that need to be brought down, and I'm doing good work. So, yeah, I believed in it, absolutely. And I felt privileged that I could be at the front of that. And also, I did find it exciting. The first few years, I loved it. And, you know, it boosts your ego as well, because I was, you know, I'd come away from really threatening situations where I've managed it really well and thought, oh, wow, so I'm one of those people who can cope with that threats of violence. I can cope with those situations, and that boosts your ego, and then you develop a reputation amongst your peers as well, and that boosts your ego. Yeah, you know, for the first few years, I was living a dream, really.
It's quite ironic, really, isn't it, when you think that back to your sort of PC days, you weren't too keen on confrontation, and then there you are, you know, thrusting, you know, with some of the most nastiest people that you could probably meet in your area. So it's quite ironic that you ended up doing what you're doing, really.
I suppose it's personality, though. I mean, the assertive use of the uniform as a tool for taking control of situations, you know, a bunch of drunks or domestic violence or something, it's not the same as being sneaky and lying to people to manipulate them to get what you want. And I suppose a lot of that comes down with whatever tools of personality you've got. And it seems I'm good at being sneaky.
You just found your niche, didn't you?
Yeah, something like that.
Can you give the audience a flavour? I appreciate you can't disclose all tactics and that, but can you give the audience a flavour of what it's like to be out there as an undercover on a sort of a daily shift?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it sort of taps into how things developed, because I didn't even know the best way to dress or behave, and I just learnt it on the fly. And, you know, to start with, I was dressing like in a full tracksuit, the Nike Air Max trainers and all that kind of thing. You know, no disrespect to anyone listening who's really into sportswear. It just happened to be the uniform of thieves, you know. So that's what I wore. But
yeah. But
I quickly realised that dressing down and mingling with the most vulnerable people in the community, was the one that was going to open more doors, because the most vulnerable people are using the most drugs. They know the most people. They've got the best connections, that kind of thing. So if I could look like I was, you know, living in a squat or something, then that's going to open more doors for me. So basically, I would have my clothes tied up in a plastic bag from the day before, so they really, really smelled. And I'd put them on, and then if there was going to be a morning briefing for the whole day's deployment, or it might have been a continuation from the day before, but if it was a morning briefing, then I'd sit around and I'd be given intel from the team, and there'd be an agreed set of aims for the day, and then I'd go out. I'd look for certain characters I'd befriended, hang around wherever they were hanging around, and if I was building legend, I would go with them to do some shoplifting, maybe steal some bottles of spirits or some children's clothes or something like that, whatever sold best in that area. I'd spend time mingling with people who handled the stolen goods, just getting the gossip, sharing a bit of gossip, talk about the drugs we bought the day before, how good they were, who had the best gear, who was ripping who off. Just all of the kind of gossip, really. There was always gossip about local cops as well. There was always one or two local cops that people loved to talk about or slag off. And that always formed a great, fabric of that of those conversations, which could be quite good fun. But then, I'd be putting a call in, and depending on what I needed to do, I'd put a call in together with a couple of other people, and hoping to get introduced. And if it was early on in a job, I was trying to get close to climb up the ladder a bit, because you can get stuck just dealing with user dealers, and you need to be dealing with the people who supply them. So I was always looking for the angle of how to get further up the ladder. Maybe it was to get a commodity that somebody liked, or in Leicester it was because I spotted somebody loved high class clothes, so I got hold of some of them to sell them, or if I knew someone was trading also in power tools, or there's all sorts of different ways. But more often than not, it was I'd spend weeks manipulating a particular vulnerable person who I knew was connected, and I would persuade them to lie for me, essentially. And I don't think I'm betraying any tactics by saying that haven't already been aired in preliminary hearings at Crown Court and voir dires. And I do get slagged off by cops for saying some of the things that I've just said. But it's a fantasy to think that organised crime don't know exactly what tactics we use. And it's a fantasy to suggest that we haven't made things worse by using those tactics, because, inevitably those tactics are sidestepped with ruthlessness by organised crime. And the truth of it is, our communities are now more dangerous as a result of people like me in those communities.
Yeah, that sort of follows on very nicely to my next question, really, in terms of, tell me about the most scariest experience that you've had as an undercover, if you can disclose that.
I get asked this, and it's really hard to say which is the scariest. I suppose it depends what mood I'm on in a day, really. I mean, I suppose one of them that I don't talk about quite as often is it was in Nottinghamshire, and I'd spent months and months trying to get close to this dealer, who rumour had it was directly in contact with Colin Gunn. He was one of his minor lieutenants, Colin Gunn being the infamous gangster who ran the Bestwood cartel. And this guy, I got a phone introduction to him, but from someone I'd been working on. And anyway, he met me. And I was working as a partner on that one, so there was two of us. We were pretending to be a couple. But I thought, well, he's so nasty, this guy, that he's going to behave much better if it's just one of us, because you can control a confrontational situation if there's two people much better. It's just like interviewing someone, isn't it? If you interview someone as a cop, you don't interview as a pair. You decide who's interviewing, then pass it on, don't you? You only use one of, because that's the way you control a conversation.
So yeah, absolutely.
I thought, right, you keep out of the way, and I'll just talk to him. Anyway, he brought his 12-year-old son, who was weirdly like a mini-me. He was dressed in his same tracksuit, shaved head, same trainers. It was really weird. And he opened this car door, and he got a knife and pressed it into my groin, as I think he drew me slightly closer to him as well with his other hand, but I don't quite remember that clearly, but I just remember the knife. And You know, it's really, really uncomfortable having a blade into your groin when you're being questioned. And it's perhaps one of the scariest things, because I became convinced he was going to permanently damage me, because I knew that's how crazy he was. And it made me sort of empathise with medieval torture victims that were going to that they knew they were going to be mutilated, because those thoughts went through my mind. I'm going to be mutilated here. And the decision, you know, that pressure to just run away was huge. So yeah, that's one that's probably contributed to my PTSD, I suspect. But you know, he sold to me eventually. But yeah, that's a scary one.
Sounds like a really scary experience to me, as you say. I can imagine having a knife put into that position would have been not the most pleasant of experiences in your life. But the good thing is that you got out of it, you kept your cool and you got out of it, and you're here to tell the tale, which is the most important thing. You touched on something early in the conversation that I think was a light bulb moment for me as well, Neil. User dealers. I've been involved in test purchase operations myself, as I said, not on an undercover, but more intervention and helping set the projects up and the operations up. And within the rest phase the one day, and one of the kids that had been locked up, and I found this during the operation, had all these gone Mr. Biggs or Mrs. Biggs that you wanted to target. But inevitably, as the progress of the operation went through, you would start to realise that a lot of the people that were being dealt to were these user dealers. And I remember sat in an interview room with this one kid, and I showed him the photographs of him dealing to the undercovers, and he just looked at me, and a tear rolled down his eye, and he said, "But I'm just sick, you know, I'm just selling because I'm trying to fund my own habit." And that was a massive light bulb moment for me. And I just wondered what your views were on that as well, in terms of, did you see that time and time again? And that must have had an effect on you too.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, I get publicity because, yeah, I did bring down some of these big gangsters occasionally, but they're a small minority of the people that I got caught and got wrapped up in it. And some of these vulnerable people who are just trying to cope with trauma, you know, they were exploited, and they are every day. These are people who are exploited by organized crime for those gangsters to make profit. And that, as he said, they are just sick people that we should be taking care of, but they're the most vulnerable and exploited in our society. And then gangsters exploit them, and then undercover cops come along and exploit them as well, you know, and they're just caught in the crossfire. And, you know, back with the British system, up until the end of the 1960s, those people would have been cared for and prescribed heroin so that they're not exploited. So, you know, in 50 years, we've gone so far in the wrong direction. These poor people need help.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was just seeing a lot of sick people getting, like, you know, anything between 2 and 3 years in prison. And at the time, it felt like a success. But then when I sit back now and I look at it, I think, what a waste of money that we spent on all those operations. And it didn't really solve the problem at all, did it?
Well, no, exactly. And sending traumatised people to prison further traumatises them and makes their problems even worse, and makes society's problems even worse, because they are more likely to continue using problematically and in larger amounts.
Yeah.
So only health interventions can help those people.
Yeah, they're going to come out and they're just going to go back to the same neighbourhoods where they were, you know, dealing. They come out with the best intentions. I was speaking to someone the other day, you know, they came out with the best intentions, but the minute they get sucked back into it, the dealer's back on them, and they're back out doing it within a very short period of time, aren't they?
Well, yeah, exactly. And there's also one element of this horrific system that people are not generally aware of, is that they are also exploited in prison. And as you probably know, Jim, that there is a whole credit system in prison that is worked out how much debt someone can accrue in prison depending on their ability to commit crime for pay for it when they come out. So, you know, there's a famous pair of brothers in Sheffield that, if there's any Derbyshire or Sheffield cops are listening to, they'll know exactly who I mean. They would always go into prison, they'd come out, and within a few months they'd be caught, and the first burglaries were committed within a couple of days. And I remember asking one of them, I said, "You don't waste much time, do you?" And he says, "Yeah, but they know in prison how much crime I can commit. So my credit rating in prison is endless, so I can use as much heroin as I want inside." And that fuels the crime, because heroin is four times more expensive in prison than on the outside.
Yeah.
So add the interest, and that's an enormous amount of crime that that's causing.
Yeah, absolutely. It really is. Hi, my name's Jim Nixon, and I've been working in antisocial behaviour for a number of years. One of the big issues facing antisocial behaviour professionals is how we effectively tackle noise complaints, and you need good tools to be able to do this. One tool that I would highly recommend is the Noise app. I've effectively used the Noise app whilst working in the housing sector and the local authority sector, and it, for me, it's the go-to tool. There's over 330 subscribing local authorities and housing associations in the UK currently using the Noise app. The Noise app was designed to relay precise information compared to traditional methods. I couldn't run an ASB team without the Noise app now. So if you want more information about the Noise app for a free trial, then contact the team on info@thenoiseapp.com today. One of the things that, I noticed, and I was interested in your views, was that in your experience, Neil, after an arrest phase, say on an undercover operation, when you've done all your evidence gathering, you've dealt to all these mid-dealers and these drug user dealers that we've talked about, once we've kind of mopped up and we've kind of got them all into custody and it leaves a gap in that market, how long on average do you think that sort of space is left for?
Well, I mean, theoretically, it depends on how dense a population it is and where people are from the main hubs. But in my experience, certainly the infamous job I did in Northampton capturing the Burger Bar Boys, there were 96 people arrested, including the six Burger Bar Boys. And there were no new names to get. That was the thing about Northampton. There was no new phone numbers to get. I knew I'd caught every single person involved in that trade in that town at that time. So I thought, well, this has got to have a big impact because everyone's caught, you know, hundreds of cops involved, hundreds. And the intel guy said afterwards to me quite clearly, he says, well, yeah, we only interrupted the supply for 2 hours, just 2 hours. Now, OK, Northampton's a big town. It's not far from Birmingham. But when I speak to others around the country, people are saying the same kind of times. And also publicly up in County Durham, Ron Hogg and Mike Barton say exactly the same thing, that their intel was exactly the same thing up in Durham, that it was only 2 hours. So seems a common figure, not just in the UK, but around the world. And of course, the important thing is that gap in the market is an important thing to concentrate on. And, you know, this word that police say nowadays that they've managed to disrupt the supply. But why is disruption a good thing? Why are police saying that this word disrupt? Well, that word has its origins in an army manual, I believe, for an army training manual for army officers. That it's a way of dealing with insurgency, that you cause disruption to that insurgency. Well, the trouble is, the drug dealing business is not an insurgency. They're not terrorists. They're business people. And if you see how that word is used in the world of business academia, business academics will say that if you want to create business growth in a marketplace, then you disrupt that marketplace. So you have cops celebrating these seizures, these arrests, these crackdowns, and saying that they've successfully disrupted. But they're unironically saying that they have created market growth. And that's the truth of this situation that we need the public to realise.
And no doubt, Neil, what that also creates is more violence on our street, no doubt, on our streets.
Yeah, and you'll know, because you've followed police intelligence during your career, and this is the problem I have where police are not being honest, because, you know, as part of the Law Enforcement Action Partnership, I speak to cops in the USA, Australia, Vietnam, South America, and, you know, an honest cop, when you ask them, In your intelligence after these operations, more often than not, does violence go up? And an honest cop will say, yes, more often than not, those police activities will increase violence in communities. The dishonest ones will say no, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's really frustrating, that is, because that's clearly what I saw. was that, you know, when that gap emerged, and it did create that kind of that fight within that community for that territory. So I saw that a few times in my career. So, you know, I can definitely say that that did go on. And one thing I'm not saying, and I think you're on record of saying this, you know, cops are brilliant at tackling drugs, aren't they? They're brilliant at the enforcement side of it. And I'm not criticising the police. I was one of them for 20 years. But I think we've just got to look at a better way of dealing with drugs within the UK and the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, the most hardworking, dedicated cops that I knew were involved in drugs investigations. And they do that because they care so much about the damage the current situation is causing to our communities. And I commend them for the energies they put into it. But we are long overdue the need to be honest, because things that the cops see through intelligence and the reality of the situation, the public don't yet understand. And the police have a duty to the truth. You know, don't get me wrong. I mean, police, yeah, they are really good at dealing with arresting drug dealers, but that's part of the problem. And the police service has been stitched up with this drug policy, stitched up. But cops will always do as they're told. They will always work as hard as possible at the tasks they're given. But it's time to change things, and we have it in our power as police voices to do that.
I totally agree with you. One of the things I was going to ask you, we were just talking about, you know, honest cops that lie. We'd all be very naive if we thought that these powerful drug gangs didn't infiltrate the police by, you know, effectively getting recruits on board within the police service to be able to be on the inside and to be give them the heads up. What is your experience of that within your service?
Well, I've come across corruption quite a lot. And one of the first things that made me realise there was a problem is actually the system that was put in place for that kind of undercover work. So basically the national system that was put in place is any undercover operative would be loaned to a local force. And before that job would start, the team would have to be, you know, specific roles. You know, your intel guy, your techie, backup, all, you know, specific roles. And they'd be put in place, and they were usually the hardworking cops who got a bit of a reward for the, you know, special job. But they'd all be sat down by the senior investigating officer at the start of that, and they'd all be given a lawful order. And they'd all be told, I'm giving you a lawful order that you are not allowed to ask the undercover operative his real name or her real name, and you're not allowed to ask her where she's from. And you will be disciplined if you do. And that was in the structure. Also, as you know, those operations are cocooned completely away from, they're not allowed to talk to cops operationally. They're completely separated. The only person allowed to access police systems is the intel guy, and only for specific agreed purposes. So that all system that was only put in place because of the existence of corruption within drugs investigation. That's why that system exists. And, you know, the public needs to realise that the internal workings of the police is trying to fight corruption, but it's not possible to fight corruption. I mean, at the job I did in Nottinghamshire, I had, you know, a few months in, two of my backup team went off sick, got introduced to two new people, and I met one of them in the morning, shook his hand, no problem. The second one, I shook his hand, and the hairs went up on the back of my neck. And I was fortunate that my instincts screamed at me not to trust this guy. And I mean screamed at me. It was a really real moment, you know. And I said, I went to the boss running it. I said, boss, sorry, I cannot have this guy knowing what I'm doing. I don't trust him. So he was great. He excluded both of them. He says, right, well, tell them they're not needed. We'll run light. And, you know, they don't know what we're doing. They weren't in the briefing, so it's fine. Didn't think much of it. 12 months later, it turned out that cop was a guy called Charlie Fletcher, who was an employee of the gangster Colin Gunn. He'd been in the cops for 7 years. He's being paid £2,000 a month on top of his police wages. But interestingly, he was paid to join the police. He wasn't corrupted from within, he was paid to join. And, you know, in the debriefs afterwards, senior cop said to me, look, Woodsy, we know this happens. You know, we've got the intel that this happens. We know it happens. But with this much money involved, how can it not happen? And that's important to know. That, you know, senior police understand this, but the public needs to know that it's so inevitable. Because if the public knows that this level of corruption is inevitable with the current policy, the public would demand change of their politicians. So again, the secret to a safer future is honesty. And, you know, I travel all over the place. I remember being told by people in Finland and in Denmark that I told them about corruption. They just said, oh, well, yeah, but we're not as corrupt as you are in the UK. And that's the attitude that people have. They don't believe it. Then, of course, the head of the Finland drug squad was found to be a member of an international organised crime group. And they had a similar problem in Denmark. And, you know, this happens. But where we hear about it, it's a tiny percentage of what's going on because most of it doesn't get found out about. And an important aspect of this, of course, is it's not just the value in the drug markets. It's the mechanism of policing that causes the corruption. Because say you arrested a kingpin type figure or a gang that controls, a quarter of a city. You know, that kind of thing happens. It's happened in Birmingham. You know, you've had a massive arrest. Someone who controls a good quarter, a big chunk of a city. The people who are most able to fight their way into taking up that opportunity, that gap in the market, is someone who controls another quarter of the city, which means a gang or individual increases their share of a market. And if someone increases their share of a market, they suddenly become richer and they suddenly have more disposable income to invest in corruption. And at every level, all around the world, that's what's happening as a result of the policing activity trying to deal with drugs through prohibition.
So it's all just, from your perspective, you know, it's all just, a lot of it is just pointless, really, in terms of how we do it in the UK at the moment. It just doesn't seem, we both know it's not working, and we've got to look at, you know, alternative ways of how we can tackle the drug problem in this country. Do you see it as a public health issue, Neil?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a public health issue. Drugs are a health issue, and criminalising people and using the police for a health issue is the wrong way to deal with it. But it's also, now we've created this monster of organised crime, and organised crime was created by this drug policy. There was no organised crime until drugs were banned. There wasn't. International organised crime, that is. And it's becoming more powerful and connected all the time. You know, the Global Initiative report on transnational organised crime calls the growing power of organised crime the greatest single threat to our security and the fabric of our democracy. So, yeah, it is a health issue. But now, obviously, it's an organised crime issue. And the only way we can tackle that in it more successfully is by treating it as the health issue it is.
Yeah. So that leads me on to LEAP, really, you know, Law Enforcement Action Partnership. Tell me about, you know, your ideas and the kind of work that you're doing at the moment with a large number of people to try and force through some of this change.
Well, our position as an organisation, I mean, we support all sorts of incremental drug policy changes that are based on evidence. We do. But ultimately, our position is that we want all drugs legally regulated to take the power away from organised crime. Because essentially, we're still looking at this through a policing lens. We want to fight the gangsters. We want to take their power away from them. So in terms of legal regulation, you know, that from the easiest one to do is heroin, by far. And because we don't need any change in legislation, we've got the legal systems in place. We've got the expertise in our history to do it. We prescribe heroin to the problematic consumers. Now, if you consider that County Lines is 80% of the County Lines market is about heroin, 20% is about crack cocaine, and most of those people are using both commodities. If you only provide medical help to the most hardcore 10% of those problematic consumers, you take away the entire market structure of County Lines overnight, because County Lines is about selling those drugs to that hardcore 10%, because that hardcore 10%, they consume 50% of the market value of the heroin. 50%. Yeah. So it's a relatively tiny number of people that you just need to take care of to protect 50,000 exploited children selling to them. If that sounds too easy, well, it would be dramatic and overnight if we did that. And we don't need a legislative change.
I've seen this. I've seen this before. No, I've seen this before. When I was a drugs cop, we went to a project up in Blackpool. I don't know if you remember it. It was a tower project. And that's exactly what they did, Neil. They prescribed heroin, and it was a multi-partnership kind of approach. And their car crime and their acquisitive crime just absolutely plummeted. And I tried to do something similar in the West Mids. And I got a doctor on board that was actually going to prescribe heroin, but it all just got kind of pushed. Oh, it's too hard to do. And it just never happened. But I think that would have been a real solution, even in the early 2000s, you know. And I just don't understand why it hasn't really been taken on.
Yeah, I mean, wherever it's happened, the evidence is so dramatic. I mean, like, astonishingly dramatic. If you look at the doctor, John Marks, friend of mine who prescribed heroin in the Wirral in Merseyside between 84 and 94. Acquisitive crime there, according to local police records, dropped 93%. 93%. Switzerland used his evidence, British evidence, to inform their policy. In Switzerland, their domestic burglaries dropped by 50%. Now, you know, from a policing perspective, why are we not all doing that? And the reason is that drug policy is based on ideology and moral judgment, and the need to judge people morally is a difficult thing to sidestep, especially when it's become so ingrained into our politics. But I have to say, again, apologies if people think I'm just criticizing the police, but another problem we've got here is that police control the narrative, and on social media, press releases, the police are constantly putting out stories of doors being smashed in, a gang's being arrested, drugs being seized, but without the context that it's not improving things. So the public are seeing these images over and over again. They're being reminded that there's something to be scared of, but they're also being reassured that something's being done about it. So again, it's time to be honest, because if we're honest, the public will very quickly get behind heroin prescribing, and our crime will drop, less people will die, organised crime will lose money and power.
How close do you think you're getting, Neil, to, you know, forcing some change? Where do you think we're at?
Well, change is happening. And actually, I can praise the police here, because it is police leaders in the UK, not around the world, but in the UK, it's police leaders which are leading this debate. And in your city of Birmingham, for example, you know, David Jamieson, as Police and Crime Commissioner, did a fantastic job of getting things moving in the West Mids, and they are moving. And soon, I understand, there will be heroin-assisted treatment working in your region. Again, another brilliant police crime commissioner up in Cleveland, Mr. Coppinger, he also brought in heroin-assisted treatment, and the evidence is there in Middlesbrough. Crime plummeted, people have survived. Again, all of the same kind of evidence. Alvin Jones has been working on it in Wales. I hope that they're going to manage to get it going in Wales. So it's actually police which are leading reforms in spite of politics, in spite of central politics rather than because of it. But, you know, we do have good allies as well. We've got the Conservative Drug Policy Reform Group. I'm going to be speaking at the Conservative Conference in October. I do a lot of events for the Labour Drug Policy Reform Group. We have some great allies in the Lib Dems, the Greens. Again, the Scottish National Party, you know, this movement, which is led by the public, you know, the public movement for this social justice, is now, it's firmly embedded in our politics as well. And it's growing. And there are lots of good people right across the political spectrum calling for an evidence-based drug policy.
That's really good to hear. You know, I'm a big advocate of the work that you're doing, but I didn't realise that you were doing, you know, you were doing so much with lots of different political parties, which is really good news to hear. When I look at this problem, you know, the whole point of this podcast is generally to look at how we can transform communities in the 21st century. And when I'm talking to you, and yeah, there's a lot to community safety, I understand that, but this is such at the core, isn't it? It really is around violence, around deprivation, around sick people. This is so key to everything, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's a cornerstone. It prevents other measures. Our current policy prevents other measures happening successfully, because we are gifting the exploitation of vulnerable people to organised crime. This is raising crime. It's meaning the exploitation of our children. And as you just pointed out, the deprivation and inequality, organized crime can take advantage of that because of this wonderful thing that we've given them, the control of these drug supply. And it's worth £10 billion a year in the UK. That's a lot of corruption. You know, as a cop, community drug dealing gangsters become community leaders. They become community manipulators. They play games with it in terms of how they manipulate the community. And we shouldn't be allowing control of our communities to the worst elements in our society.
They kind of become sort of community heroes, don't they?
Yeah, they do. You know, there's the famous names like Massey in Salford, who obviously got shot, and, you know, the Colin Gunn, and all of these people. Yeah, they become these egocentric sort of kingpin figures, but that's because we've given them the power, you know, and we can strip that power away from them and we can do so much more. And also, you know, we can afford a lot more interventions and a lot more health interventions if we redirect that money away from the criminal justice system, because, you know, there's 50 to 60,000 people in prison that shouldn't be there, that's only causing more harm and that's only building in more harm for the future when they come out as more traumatized people, or their children are traumatized because they're missing their parents, and we seal in that trauma for the next generation. We can be doing better things, but we have to start with drug policy reform and, you know, decriminalization, legally regulated cannabis market, legally regulated MDMA market, all of them, all of the incremental changes. The more we do, the more we'll fight back.
Yeah, I think it's brilliant, mate. I think the work you're doing with Leap is absolutely fantastic. And as I say, I'm a massive supporter of what you're doing. How far do you think we're going to get in our lifetime, Neil? Do you think we'll see some real change in our lifetime over the next sort of, you know, 15, 20 years or so?
Oh, God, I don't know, because there's so many facets of this and there's so many ways of arguing it to different audiences, and it means different things to different audiences. But at the moment, I'm working with some colleagues at Health Poverty Action to see if we can challenge COP26, because, you know, we at Leap, we do lots of work internationally as well. And there's a truth about drug policy that the public needs to know, that because of the extent of corruption internationally, whatever they agree as recommendations at COP26 in terms of the climate crisis and the action that's needed, you know, you can talk to governments in Brazil or Guinea or various other places that are destroying their equatorial forests, but the governments don't have control of their own backyards. And the reason for that is the corruption caused by drug policy. Now, the Global Initiative have identified that many West African countries, including Guinea, that are losing trees at the fastest rate in the world, that they are now narco states, like entirely run by transnational organised crime, completely. Same with Senegal, Guinea-Bissau, and lots of other places. So you can't stop the logging now, because the government doesn't control that backyard. And the reason for that is that the environmental vandalism, or rather the reinvestment in drug profits to make more money, comes because of the $500 billion that industry creates for the illicit market. And you can't fight that corruption unless you take that business away from organised crime. So there's a wake-up call coming in the next decade as we increasingly talk about how to tackle this climate emergency. And again, drug policy is behind so much, but it's also a cornerstone issue that will prevent climate action unless we start dealing with it now.
So important. And as I say, Neil, I wish you all the best with this work, you know, and the more people we can get on the bandwagon with this, and I'm hoping that, you know, podcasts like this will, you know, open people up to change and, you know, different ways of doing things. So, you know, I can't thank you enough for raising some of the awareness on today's episode. We're coming to the end, really, more or less now, and I always ask a question at the end. Is there anything that I haven't asked you today that you would like to cover before we wrap up the interview?
Well, quite often if I have an audience, people say, okay, yeah, you've won me over. I'm willing to become part of this social movement. And because, of course, any social justice issue through history, whatever it is, whether it's about the death penalty, ending criminality for homosexuality, gender equality, whatever the social justice issue. These changes don't tend to come from political leadership. They come from the growth of social movements. So if you're listening to this and you're on board, you are now part of that social movement. And quite often an audience will say, okay, I'm part of the movement. What can I do? So there's many things you can do. You can write to your MP and you can write to them again. And whenever the drug policy issue comes into the news, you can write to them again. And it makes a difference, because I know many MPs and they say it makes a difference. They sit up and take notice. You can follow and share the product of Leap UK, our good partners at Anyone's Child, which are a very important organisation. You can look them up and follow them and support them. If you think you can host an event that where Anyone's Child and Leap UK can speak at, then get in touch. You know, if you can host it, we've got the organisational skills and the promotion. We'll do it. You know, we've been to very small communities in West Wales. We'll come anywhere we're invited. But also there's little things that we're trying to do to influence the narrative. So I mentioned earlier on in the interview that the police control the narrative. And Anyone's Child and Leap UK, we've done a rather cheeky little video. And maybe in your promotion for this, you can send out links to it if you'd be so kind, Jim.
Of course, no, yeah.
And it's a video which, because the police are increasingly using social media to post their pictures of what they're claiming to be success, you know, their big hay bale block size of cocaine or their big cannabis grow or whatever it is, we've got this cheeky little video which explains the reality of what it means when police actually have those seizures, that actually crime tends to go up and that this shouldn't really be claimed as a success. So it was made for anyone out there to use as a tool. So wherever you see, anywhere in the world, because there's different language versions of this as well, German, Spanish, even Mongolian, wherever you are, please post it in the comments politely and politely ask the police officers or staff who posted that social media post to view the video and respond if they feel they can. And it's having amazing effect, because cops are getting in touch with us. And as long as it's used politely, you know, it's a way of engaging people in the debate. And it's something you can do, you know, it's something tangibly that you out there can do to take part in this social movement.
That's brilliant, that, isn't it? Great advice there. And to all our listeners, you know, I'll post that link about that video from Neil's perspective. And I've seen that video, Neil, and it is really impactful. So absolutely, we'll look at getting in. And like, you're absolutely right, you know, it's all about social movement. And, you know, the more people we can get on board with this and write into MPs, the more we're going to force change. So absolutely brilliant advice. I couldn't let you go, Neil, without mentioning your two fantastic books, Good Cop, Bad Cop War and Drug Wars. I take it they're available on Kindle and in all major bookstores.
Yeah, available everywhere. World Productions are working on making a TV dramatization of Good Cop, Bad War, the first book. So, you know, in the world of TV, nothing is guaranteed, but it's looking quite positive for having read the first episode script for that.
Brilliant. Looking forward to that. And I highly recommend both books. Really cracking reads, and you'll learn a lot from them. So, yeah, get out there and look at those books if you can, and look on your Kindle. How can people reach out to you, Neil? If they want to make contact?
Well, I'm pretty active on Twitter, because that's where a lot of the drug policy debate happens. So that's at Woodsy, and I'll spell that because I got this handle before I knew I was going to be public, at WUDZEE0. But more importantly than me is follow Leap on Twitter or Instagram, which is at UKLeap. In America, we are at Police for Reform. And then, of course, we're also active on Facebook. And, you know, if anyone's out there in Europe as well, there's Leap France, Leap Germany, and we're going to be launching the overarching Leap Europe around Europe as well.
Fantastic, Neil. Neil, you're an absolute legend. I can't thank you for all the work you're doing. You know, it's absolutely fantastic. Yeah, I want to just make it clear again, you know, we're not having a pop at police officers here. You know, we've both been them. We understand the pressures, but we both understand from our own experiences that things have got to change. And, you know, the police obviously play a big part in that along with the government. So big thank you to me, Neil. Really appreciate your input today. It's been absolutely amazing.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jim. And that was very well put just then, yeah.
No problem at all. Thank you for listening to the Community Safety Podcast. We really do appreciate your support. We're actually coming to the end of our podcast series now. This is our 20th episode with Neil. So we are going to be taking a little bit of a break for a couple of months. But look out on social media because we're going to be all over the place and we're going to be advertising some of our new guests. And also, just before I go, a new feature, which is the option to buy the podcast a coffee. This helps this amazing podcast to keep going. To donate, just please go to the website, which is www.thecommunitysafetypodcast.com/donate. Thanks again for your amazing support during this season one, and we will catch you in season two. I really enjoyed that interview with Neil Woods. I've followed him very closely for a number of years, and I think he talks an awful lot of sense. We really do need to look at reforms around our drug policy in the UK. And as I say again, you know, it's not a criticism of, you know, the police officers on the ground doing some amazing work, but we do need to look at some kind of radical change if we are to reduce violence and improve our public health and also reduce our prison population. So thanks again for listening to the Community Safety Podcast. This is the 20th episode and the end of season one, and it's just been an amazing journey. We are now a top 0.5% worldwide podcast, and I can't thank you all enough for your support. Please continue to share the message. We really do want to keep spreading the news about how we can transform communities in the 21st century, and encourage your friends and colleagues to listen to the whole of season one. It's there for everybody to listen to. And again, we'll catch you in the very near future for season two.
You've been listening to the Community Safety Podcast. With thanks for support from St. Ives Chambers, RHE Global and Me Learning. Join us again next time to help us explore how we can transform our communities in the 21st century. On the Community Safety Podcast with Jim Nixon.